Hello, I'm composer Joshua Shank, and welcome to Have You Heard This? The podcast where me and my colleague John Fielder talk about classical music and not being a dick about it. All right, and welcome to Have You Heard This? Hi, John, how you doing, my friend?
I am doing pretty good. How are you doing, Joshua?
I'm good. Not to make a boring discussion, but the heat finally broke here in Boston, and last week it was awful.
Oh, yeah? What was it?
Yes. It was like hovering in the hundreds, which this city is not super prepared for.
No.
No city really is, but... You and I used to live in Austin, Texas, and they're a little bit more well prepared for it, I would say.
Slightly better, yeah. Again, as prepared as you can be for the weather.
Sure. For what may have been now the coldest summer of the rest of our lifetimes.
True. Yeah, that's
heard that.
Fucking depressing.
Yeah, I heard that on a local, I think it was not the Boston Globe, it was one of the other podcasts that one of our local media companies. They do one of those daily podcasts that are like maybe 12 minutes long once a day. So it they're like a nice thing to listen to in the morning. Last weekend, Robert and I did the Barbenheimer thing.
Oh, did you? What did you think?
Yeah. We didn't go back to back. As much as I love the movies, and I do. That's like 5 hours in a theater is a little bit too much. So we saw Barbie on, obviously I had some friends cancel dinner party things on Friday. So we went and saw Barbie. We got the last two seats in the theater. And you know what? Pretty good. Ryan Gosling understood the assignment. And I mean, Margot Robbie is fantastic too, but Ryan Gosling had to be a real specific kind of like idiot. And you know what? Totally got it.
He had to be a beautiful idiot.
He had to be a beautiful idiot. That's correct. Yeah. And then Oppenheimer was fantastic. I think I'm a fan of those Christopher Nolan movies, and I really only need to see them once, maybe, you know?
I'm with you there on Christopher Nolan in general. I like what I've seen, but I don't really ever feel the need to see it twice.
I'd say the Dark Knight stood up to...
I'll give you that.
Heath Ledger's performance is just so, like, transfixing, I think.
Right. Well, that's nice. I saw neither of those, so I'm definitely in the out group here, just in general. But I do plan on seeing both, but probably not until they hit streaming services. I'm kind of over going to theaters right now. It's just not something I want to do.
Yeah, I get you.
The whole rigmarole of doing it. I also tend to fall asleep easily in theaters, so... That might be part of it. It's very expensive, and then I just take a very expensive nap.
Yeah, I hear that. Well, in any case, I hope you enjoy them when you finally do lay eyes on them. What have you been up to, man?
Oh, not a whole lot. Just writing some music. Recently finished a piano piece that I'm pretty happy with, and otherwise just kind of tinkering, enjoying the Minnesota summer weather. It broke here a long time ago, so we've been dealing with like upper 90s pretty consistently for the last few weeks.
And I'll say to our listening audience, John sent me the piano piece that he's been working on, and it's quite something, my friend. I like it.
I liked it a lot. I appreciate it. It was a memoriam piece for Cormac McCarthy that I wrote in the weeks following his passing. So
is that the title with the titles in reference to?
Yeah, it's one of the last lines. I shouldn't say last lines. It's one of the last lines in the last monologue of his book Stella Maris, which was the last novel he wrote, which is very good. If you haven't read it and you're a Cormac McCarthy fan, I strongly recommend that one.
Nice. You want to get into some tunes?
I do, always.
All right, we'll be right back. All right, and we're back. We're going to do something today that I never thought I would be doing, which is digging in really deep to a piece by Dominic Argento. did you know any of Argento's works before we kind of like started on this process?
Not too much, no. And I found myself constantly referring to him as Dario Argento when I... Which is not the same thing at all.
Very different kind people. Of Argento, yeah.
Yeah, very, very different outputs there between Dominic and Dario. But no, not a lot. I mean, a few one-offs here and there, maybe heard some of it live. But like, I was familiar enough with the name, but not with this piece at all.
Yes, he is not the giallo Italian filmmaker.
No.
That maybe some of you have seen, like, Suspiria, yeah. That one, yeah.
Deep Red, yeah.
Yeah, so this piece, it's called Dover Beach Revisited. It is for choir and piano, an SATB choir, excuse me, mixed choir and piano. Uses a very famous text by Matthew Arnold. It was given its Midwestern premiere. Well, first of all, it was commissioned by the Yale Glee Club back in, I think, maybe 2005. I don't know. The professional choir that I sang in when I lived in the Twin Cities, we did the Midwestern premiere of it. And it was my first experience with Argento's works, which from the standpoint of somebody who came from I would say I still think of myself as a terrible musician, and then to look at this piece, I felt like I was being handicapped by Argento himself because of the beat level. And so I kind of brought this one because I have a little soft spot in my heart for it, but then also it, I would say, has non-traditional notation is a little bit too far out there, but non-standard notation for a mixed choir, I would say.
Does it? I did not. I mean, in what way? I don't mean that in like a shitty way, like me like getting a jab in. Like, I genuinely am curious to hear about this one.
So when I think back to this piece, I think back to having to learn it myself, which is, I was in this tiny apartment in White Bear Lake, Minnesota. Go Bears. Which is up on your side of the Twin Cities. That's Ooh. Up in the, on the eastern side. And I had this terrible keyboard, and I, had come from the Lutheran choral tradition. Not that I am Lutheran myself, but that's where I kind of came from. And this piece, its beat level is like, it's a larghetto, mm-hmm. where the beat level is like around 65 beats per minute, but the bass beat is an eighth note. So you have like dum ba da da dee da da dee, right? Like these, you know, kind of like, they're not rapid fire, but they're certainly not slow rhythms. Mm. And it's, the beat level is at the eighth note. So there's bars everywhere in this piece. And it took my legs out from under me when I was trying to learn it for the first time.
And correct me if I'm wrong here. I heard this at some point, and this might be totally off base. But is it true that a lot of choral music tends to shy away from using beams? Like, rather than see 4/16th notes beamed, you would see them as 4-flagged 16th notes, right?
That's an old style notation. Okay. And that is something that I like actively revolt against.
Oh my God, it's the worst. It's the absolute worst.
Yeah, you can't see the beat definition. And I've actually taken Samuel Barber to... back in 2007, when people still wrote blogs, I wrote a blog about Barber's Reincarnations, which are fantastic works. But I also wrote a little something something about this piece in general.
Oh, okay.
I'll throw it in the chat, and you can kind of just see what I mean. So if you're looking at this blog that I wrote when I was in my very early 20s, or not very early 20s, maybe my mid 20s, and I was like still, I was just really on fire for music and I wanted to like understand it. And I saw this piece where you get like a 3/8 bar and it's 2 and 3 and French coast, the light gleams and is gone. Now that's all beat level. Eighth note. So you get all these bars that I had like not seen it, things notated that way before. And it, I just remember shouting like curse words in my apartment because I was so frustrated that I had to like relearn basically how to ride the bike again at the beat level. Well, 10 years ago, okay, a wonderful colleague of mine. Her name, she's a brilliant composer in her own right. Her name is Abby Batinas. She is the is still or was one of the composers in residence for the Schubert Club in St. Paul. And Argento was really, really identified with the Twin Cities. He won a Pulitzer for his from the Diary of Virginia Woolf. And he won that Pulitzer from the desk, his desk at the University of Minnesota. He wrote, helped found what became the Minnesota Opera, which has gone on to commission Pulitzer winning pieces as well. For I'll say that in the same breath, say that like awards are awards, and you can emphasize them or not. But he was really heavily identified with St. Paul and Minneapolis, the Twin Cities. And so when I got this kind of frantic text from Abby that said, I did an interview with Dominic Argento, and I think he reads your blog. Mm. And this is a guy who's like 83 years old. Anyway, I'm going to share this and we'll drop the clip in and you can see how kind of Argento kind of tears me apart a little bit. And then you can decide whether or not you think he's right or whether I'm right or whether we're both right. Here's the brilliant composer Abby Batinas interviewing Dominic Argento about the criticism of his music.
There's a composer here in town who seemed to have a blog. I didn't see what I thought. Who also criticized me for exactly that. The criticism. I mean, why? And I have a very substantial answer for it. Look at Stravinsky's Capriccio for piano and orchestra, it's a work he wrote in the 20s. Mm-hmm. Most people don't even know it's very played. I owned it, and I was part of it. And I remember the very famous, he had things that, what are those, 132nd notes or other? I can't remember. And he uses very small units that way. Mm-hmm. And I've read his explanation of it, which is the smaller the players pay more attention. He said, when you see 16th notes and a dotted 16th all by a 32nd, you really sit up and take notes. You see a dotted quarter followed by an eighth, no big deal, I've been there before.
So you relax as a performer.
You relax
when you see larger durations.
I mean, yeah. I feel that way. You look at a piece like Palestrina, it all just looks so plain with all of those quarter notes and an endless flood of quarter notes. But you look at something like Stravinsky, so
That's Dominic Argento taking me to task.
A little bit, yeah. He kind of gave it to you a little bit there.
He did. And you know what? That Mr. Argento is, may he rest. He could do that even when he was still with us, and that's fine, yeah. You know? I disagree with him still to this day.
Do you? So. That's a pretty commonly held belief I've come across from a number of composers who write, or at least claim that one reason they write the way they do and notate the way they do is, you know, to engage more with the performer, hope that a performer would engage more with the music than because of the way it's notated. Crumb said something similar to that, and his music is goddamn gorgeous.
And notoriously difficult to look at, I would say.
Difficult? Well, I don't know.
Or difficult looking, maybe?
Yeah, it does. It does look difficult. Some of it. Some of it's notated really plainly. I guess it just depends on which passage you're looking at and which piece.
All that being said, this difficult music that when I was, you know, 24 and was just bashing my head up against it, this really difficult music, for me at the time at least, ends up sounding really serene, which I think is the whole point of the poem. I mean, the first line is, the sea is calm tonight, the tide is full, the moon lies fair upon the strait. And Argento sets that passage like this.
Thank you.
Yeah. What did you think about this piece, John?
I liked it. I'll be perfectly honest. I didn't pay much attention the first pass. I kind of just let it play in the background and sort of half listened to it while I did other things and puttered around. Not that I didn't think much of it. I didn't pay much attention to it the first time around, so it didn't really stick with me. Second time, I really enjoyed it. It was pretty striking. The texture throughout from start to finish is homophonic, which I was going to ask you about, you know, how common is that? I don't think that's something we've seen yet in any of the stuff you've brought in. I don't think is something I've really come across just in my own listening to a lot of choral music, to have something, at least not outside of traditional sacred music that you might pick up in a history class, you know, now and then.
Or like a Bach chorale or
something like that. There's a lot of imagery in the way he writes for the voice and a lot of the phrasing and, you know, dynamic swelling and contracting. I don't know. It came off as just being really well written for voice. I know you were talking about it looking very complex on the page, but just when I went through, it looked so simple, but like almost sounds simpler even still.
Yeah. It's for me, it's the experience of hearing the choir read the poem basically. And it's not, I mean, maybe it would surprise you in some of his other works, he just actively uses tone rows and then melds that with this sort of operatic voice leading principles. His late wife, he sort of very publicly described her as his muse. She was a gorgeous opera singer, and he grew to be kind of this vocal composer. He was the first composer ever to have a production at the City Opera that was in English, but then also had English supertitles, which seems like that's a totally normal thing for, especially that we grew up in, you know, the era of just closed captioning, you click it and there it is. Oh, yeah. So we're used to that. But I mean, at the time it was, I imagine, fairly revolutionary. I mean, other than, you know, there's some really, really fine technique in it. Mm-hmm. I would say, I have listened to this piece over a dozen times and it's given an incredible performance. It's the world premiere recording of it by the singers, Minnesota choral artists, on their latest album called Come to the Woods. It's all these sort of nature pieces, including what I believe to be Argento's last four works. And it's four seasons. The thing that Argento is often kind of like associated with is this literary erudition. He sets Melville, he sets like Virginia Woolf, also like Elizabeth Barrett Browning or John James Audubon, who is the sort of very specifically associated with cataloging of birds. I don't really have a summing up of this piece or why I like it. I just know that it's really well made. There are a couple moments in here where all of a sudden he takes a full left turn into just unison choir singing, mm-hmm. and it's revolutionary.
It actually comes also right before, and the first time it happens is a very short passage, and then the whole choir says listen, and then it all goes into singing, you know, just in octaves. And that's a really striking and very powerful moment, I think, in this piece.
Yeah, let's listen to just a little bit of it. He'll start on this unison middle C, and then it's a wedge formation where the sopranos and altos move up and the basses and tenors move down, and it sounds like this. The last thing that I want to highlight about this piece, I think the final passage that occurs around about page 12 is just bananas crazy, because certainly the tenors do their job by the top of page 13, where the altos are now singing below the tenors and the tenors are screaming high up on this G. Mm-hmm. And that's the last clip I want to play before we get into some even more gnarly music from John. Mm. And the words for this portion, it's the very the last four systems of the entire piece. And the text is this: "And we are here as on a darkling plain, swept with confused alarms of struggle and flight, where ignorant armies clash by night." And he's looking on the cliffs of Dover, I imagine, the beach that's down below. Gorgeous text by Matthew Arnold. Here's the final passage. We'll be right back.
Okay, and we are back, and we're going to be talking about a piece today by a composer, performer, cellist, modular synth guru named Heather Stebbins. This piece is called...
She's a multi-hyphenate.
Right, yeah, multi-hyphenate for sure. She is really incredible. And so this piece is called Things That Follow, and it can be found on the Music from Seamus Volume 30 CD. Was composed in 2018 for percussionist Adam Vidixis, who, if you're not familiar with Adam Vidixis, you should probably check him out as well. He's also a multi-hyphenate composer, performer, researcher, educator, so there's a lot of talent going on in this piece. Before I get too much into it, it's a piece for percussion and electronics, some live processing, some just fixed sounds, and the instrumentation is really interesting. It's for bass drum with an overturned cymbal, so the bell of the cymbal is resting against the head of the bass drum, and then tam-tam, and then a whole plethora of striking implements and plectra for those instruments. And before we get into the full discussion, I just want to read the very, very short program note from the album, the Music from Seamus album. It says, Heather Stebbins' Things That Follow for Percussion and Electronics tracks the intensity of severe experiences and the subsequent lightness when they subside. And that's all they
say. I'll
say,
John, if our listeners don't want to search for that kind of very specific album, mm-hmm. they can also go to haveyouheardthispodcast.com where it's featured on a playlist.
Absolutely. Yep. Sometimes those Music from Seamus CDs are a little bit hard to find in the streaming services. Or even better, if you want to follow along with the score, it's on Score Follower. So if you just search Heather Stebbins and then Things That Follow, it'll pop right up and you can actually follow along with the score as the music's playing. And I've got some things to say about the score, but with that, I kind of just want to do the same and open it up to you, Josh. Let's see. What did you think of this one?
I think you should play a clip to kind of level set the listener before we jump into this one, because it's a neat piece.
Let's do that. Let's start right from the beginning. We'll play the first maybe 30 seconds or so of it so you can get an idea of what you're in for.
Thank you.
I should also say that if you haven't gone to the score follower to take a look at this thing, you absolutely have to take it. You have to look at this score. You know, it's not in my world of the closest I've ever seen would be like R. Murray Schafer's Epitaph for Moonlight. How would you describe how this score is notated, John?
I actually was going to talk about the notation of the score. It's all done by hand, and I think the best way to say it is she's notating physical gestures rather than notating. I mean, there are rhythms in it, to a degree. There are instructions, though, and pictures. So, for instance, if using like a super ball or a rubber ball attached to a stick, rather than just say super ball, there's a drawing of a ball on a stick. And if the percussionist is supposed to drag that in circles around the head of the bass drum, you would see the stick on the or the ball on the stick, and then a circle, and then an instruction that might say like center of bass drum, within drawings of how then you might drag that along the surface of the bass drum. Or, you know, if you're using two hands and she's requesting that you start in the center of the drum and gradually move outward to the edge and then back, you would see the drawing of the implement, and then lines that sort of go out from each other and then come back to the center, sort of making like a diamond shape. So it's almost like you're reading in real time what you're supposed to do physically rather than looking at, you know, rhythms that you should play in time and space.
And there are some time codes in it, though.
There are. And in part because there are what I mentioned before, there's live and fixed electronics. So some of this is fixed playback of sounds, and then some of it is live processing of the bass drum and the tam-tam themselves.
Like, no two performances of this would be the same.
No, absolutely correct? Not. Yeah. Even, yeah. I've had the pleasure of hearing Adam perform it once, but I imagine even he probably doesn't perform it the same way twice, you know? Which I think is kind of, it's not just a cool part about that from, like, a compositional and listening standpoint, but as a performer, it's got to be an enjoyable piece to play because you can always bring something a little bit different to the table. Even though you're essentially doing similar things, you still get to, you know, without it being like an openly improvisatory piece, there's a lot of room left for the performer to bring a lot to the table.
I didn't even think about that. So I wrote, does this need a live performance, or does it live in a really cool place mixed, you know? And because I'm only listening to one performance of it, and the way that the live and the electronic sounds kind of meld together don't remind me exactly of that Christopher Chandler piece that you brought in, but they mesh in a really cool way.
I don't know that anyone has ever really talked about it or written about it, at least not that I'm aware of. I was doing some research on a paper on this topic, but kind of abandoned that after I got out of academia. On electroacoustic pieces and acoustic pieces that are really designed to be heard as recordings rather than live performances. One example is like Wero by Helmut Lachenmann, where if you watch a live performance of that, it's kind of underwhelming. But if you listen to a recording of it, it's one of the most incredible pieces I've ever heard. You know, that would be one. Panayotis Kokkaras, a Greek composer, has a lot of acoustic pieces that would sound very different live than they do in the recording. And, you know, you get these close mics on the instruments, and you really pull out this character that you just can't really get even from an amplified performance. So I think a live performance of this piece does sound really great. You can get a really good mix of it, but I also see where you're coming from, that it almost, I don't want to say exists better as a recorded piece, but the experience is definitely modified.
it reminds me of how theatrical percussion performances are.
Yeah.
Because there's so much bodily movement around. I'm thinking of one that I saw during my time in Austin where it was a trio of percussionists around an overturned bass drum. And it's crazy and fun, and it's really amazing the sounds they get out. They use a Super Bowl, which is, that was the first time I ever saw one of those used on a bass drum. But then at the very end, they puncture a paper bag of buckshot, I think.
Was that line upon line?
Yeah. That's it. And so it's really theatrical. Yeah, so one of the other things that I wrote was, have you seen this live? And it sounds like, I mean, I can't imagine that. Well, you would bring something like this not having seen it live, but I would also expect you to have seen it live.
I have heard this one live. I've seen it. It's pretty incredible to watch, especially like I've watched Adam perform a lot. He's a big mover and a shaker in the electronic music world in America, you know, and he's an incredible performer. He's, you know, top notch musician, but like he's one of those people who is really captivating to watch as well when he's performing. And so with a piece like this, it just enhances that, you know, to another level.
Yeah. And there's those, what's not line upon line. What's the other famous kind of percussion trio? They work with Lang a lot. So percussion. And there's pieces I've seen concert footage of them playing terracotta pots, which are, I forget what David Lang piece is. Oh, it's called So-Called Laws of Nature.
Yeah, I've seen that perform live as well. It's really incredible.
So I guess my question about this piece is, My biggest one that I wrote down was, when you say basically to hell with pitch, it opens up a lot of expressive capabilities that get foreclosed on when you embrace pitch in a way that I kind of often talk about. Mm-hmm. And percussion is good for that, it seems.
Yeah, but I wouldn't say this piece is completely devoid of pitch, mostly because of the second half.
No, not at all.
But the first half really centered around the bass drum and the overturned cymbal. Definitely a lot less... almost no focus on pitch, really. It's just sound and timbre and texture and gesture and motion is really the main focus there. And it really opens you up into this sound world that I think gets ignored a lot. You know, we think about pitch and rhythm all the time, in general. And we think about things like timbre and instrumentation and orchestration and stuff, but outside of writing for percussion, it's rare that outside of the electronic music world that you focus just on sound as your primary tool compositionally.
Absolutely. Yeah, I guess I find pieces like this, well, listening to them, not necessarily watching them, even more fascinating than like the Ergun piece that you brought time around. There's, you can also sort of talk about some of the indications that she puts in, like slow swirls, varying speed lightly, almost hypnotic.
Yeah. In a circular motion, at one point, moving toward rim in both directions.
And then at one point, we're crumpling paper all of a sudden. And at one point, you're crumpling paper in a childlike manner.
I think my favorite is under the rests where it says be still, where it's like it's... I think that kind of attention to detail to the actual, I think she's really thinking a lot about theatricality in general here because of the way, you know, the music is notated in a very physical gestural way. And then to even say like in a rest, not just, you know, don't play, but don't play and be physically still during this moment. Having a visual component, whether it's the performer or the score, really brings out a lot in this piece.
Yeah, I'll link to it on our webpage, haveyouheardthispodcast.com. Let's listen to another clip of it.
Thank you.
So, okay. So can I want to ask you a question,
okay.
From your standpoint, and it's a simple one. How do you compose a piece like this? Do you think about form first? Do you think about, certainly theatricality? I don't know. This is so far away from my experience, but I still really enjoyed it, yeah. That it makes me curious to know more.
I mean, I can tell you the way I would go about writing a piece like this, and I don't have anything that's quite on this level of written out physical gesture and graphic notation, at least not anything that I'm proud of that's out in the world, just experiments and stuff.
It's not very kerplunkety. It's,
you know, it could be more kerplunkety for me. I think for me, if I were to sit down and write a piece like this, I would probably think, you know, all right, it's for percussion and electronics. Is it going to be for live or fixed electronics or both? That's usually the first thing you figure out, just from a technical standpoint. And then it's, all right, well, what kind of sounds do I want to hear? Or what kind of sounds do I hear in my head? What percussion instruments will best be used to make those sounds? And then I would probably think about, well, how are the percussion and the electronics going to interact? And then honestly, if it was me, I would probably find a bunch of sounds. I would start collecting sounds that are maybe going to make it into the piece, maybe not going to make it into the piece, but start listening to those. And then thinking about the gestural activity that they have, you know, is there a lot of like shh, something like that? If I hear that in a sound of like, I don't know, like ratcheting something and I hear like in the ratchet, I would think, well, how can I maybe replicate that on an instrument? And or what are all of the gestures that I might make on a drum or cymbal or tam tam, and then how can I maybe replicate those with other sounds? Or, you know, it's just sort of thinking about the two different sound worlds of the electronics and the instruments, and thinking about how do I want them to meld together, how do I want them to be their own entities, what is the best way to go about doing that, and then a lot of experimentation and playing with materials in that way. I do a lot of improvisation in the studio whenever I recently finished a piece last fall called Interobtrusion for, it's just fixed media, fixed electronics. And there is one moment that lasts about 5 to 8 seconds of a paper bag rustling. And I extracted that 5 to 8 second clip from like a 5.5 minute long improvised recording I made with a paper bag, crumpling and tearing and doing all of this shit with a paper bag. And that's what I extracted out of it. But going through all of that, I was like, oh, that's a cool gesture. I wonder if I can make that with something else. Oh yeah, that actually sounds better as like creaking floorboards rather than a crumpling paper bag, you know, things like that. So that's a very long-winded response to how I might go about composing something that is a little bit similar to this piece.
It reminds me a little bit of, have you seen Will Ferrell's audition for SNL?
I have not, no. Is it good? I imagine it's amazing.
Well, at one point he plays just like a CEO, and you have to imagine it's just like a desk sat up on the stage. There's nothing else there. You have to use your kind of imagination. Mm-hmm. And he's like a CEO, and he goes, he like hits his, you know, the button to the intercom to the assistant and says like, all right, yes, go ahead and hold all my calls. Hold on. Yes. Thank you for the next 30 minutes. Thank you. And then he gets down on all fours and he has this thing of yarn and he starts batting it back and forth like a cat. And then there's like, and he's like, excuse me, yep, Mrs. Smith, no, I did ask you 30 sec. I need 30 minutes. Okay, great, thank you. And then back to it again, starts batting it around. And this reminds me of, like you said, the 3 to 5 minutes of improvising by crumpling up a paper bag.
Five and a half minutes.
Oh,
five and a
God.
Half minutes of crumpling a paper bag. Yep.
I bet you got some good sounds.
I got though. 5 to 8 seconds worth of good stuff. But it's not uncommon that, you know, I'll do that a lot. You know, I did that once with a flask that my brother gave me. I just played around screwing the lid on and off. Yeah. And that ended up becoming an entire piece where I sort of improvised the flask lid and then ran that through a tool called a GRM Freeze. It's a plugin, that and a few other, you know, effects, and just kind of improvise those effects, you know, changing the parameters and stuff in real time. And that turned into this piece, Cross-Threaded, which is, you know, also fixed electronics, no instruments involved, but it's kind of that same idea where you think of one thing that you know, one germ of an idea and you play around with it and experiment and then you see what else comes. That's how I would go about writing a piece like Things That Follow is, you know, determine the instruments and then start exploring them and see what all they're capable of doing.
Now, mark me if I'm wrong here, Dr. F, but you've had some pretty substantial like wins with some fixed media performances recently, right?
Yeah, off and on. A little bit. I just had a piece played in Argentina last month, or no, in June now, I guess. We're, as of recording this, it is August now. So yeah, and I got had a performance at Ball State earlier this year, and that same piece, Inner Obtrusion, is going to be played at an SCI conference this November. So yeah, got the fixed media is moving around.
Well done. Congratulations.
I appreciate that. Shameless, shameless plug that I didn't have to do myself.
I'll always plug for you, my friend. I am not a huge fan of this, of the genre of music that you write, except the fact that you write it and I am a fan of yours.
That's all that matters to me.
Yeah. You know, and so your intelligence and wit and skill always pull me into your pieces that you write, which as evidenced by the piano piece that you sent, earlier this week, thank you. To kind of get another set of ears on that mid-range stuff. And it's fantastic. Mm. I look forward to hearing it.
Thank you.
That being said, what do you think you might bring in next time?
I have not decided. I had a couple ideas in mind, but I don't know that either of them are really pieces that I can talk about in any kind of substantial way. So I think I might figure that out as in the coming weeks as we figure out when we're going to tape again. What about you? Any idea?
Similar thing. There's a piece of Julia Wolf's that I love, but I want to make sure that I can do it justice. Mm-hmm. So I need to dig in. Kind of dig in real hard on that. But I have some other things I have to finish with this piece for Harvard. And I just got, I want to call for scores at the Juventus New Music Ensemble. Ooh. So they're going to be giving the Northeastern premiere of my piece called Flocking Music. Mm. John, where can they find you on the old social medias?
I can be found on Facebook and Instagram. Facebook is John Fielder. Instagram is John Fielder Music. Do not look for me on the Twitterverse anymore. I've decided to leave that horrid, awful place.
Yeah, you're not on X.
I'm not on
anymore.
X. No, you can't find me on X anymore. So you can find me on Bandcamp at johnfielder.bandcamp.com. And that's really the primary places. How about you, Josh? Where can we find you?
Oh, yeah, all the regular places. Facebook, Instagram, I'm at the Joshua Shank. Of course, you can find me at joshuashank.com. If you want to dig in a little bit further, if this is your first episode with us, you can go to haveyouheardthispodcast.com for all of our previous ones. Through that website, you can also access our Facebook and our Instagram. And yeah, that's it. I guess we'll see you next time around, buddy.
Sounds good. See ya.